I hear some booming. A little extra bass there. I need it. I don't know if I'm going to be able to preach this morning. I'm absolutely exhausted. Paula made me play a song in the key of B. And it's just not done. Well, it's kind of like being on a plane, you know. It's not a full flight. You can stretch out a little bit. That's good. And I've thought it might be fun to be there in Herky Creek until I saw the weather report for the weekend, and I know it might be good to be indoors. You have a Bible with you or near you? Good. We'll be using it. I love to read. I'm not sure if it's a hobby or an addiction. Maybe it's an addictive hobby. It's not a terribly productive hobby, that's for sure. Losing oneself in literary mindscapes, imagining a world crafted in the mind of another, scanning lines of symbols, unpacking their meaning, turning the pages, anticipating the plot, drinking Diet Coke. Productive? Not really. Pleasurable? Yes, indeed. At least to me. One of my favorite genres of fiction is the mystery. Nothing beats a good whodunit. But I've discovered over the years that there are rules to reading a mystery novel. I'd like to share them with you. Rule number one, never believe anything. See, there's a contest between you and the author. And the contest from we the reader's side is to avoid the false clues and fabrications inserted there just to fool us a little bit. Now, the author doesn't want you to be miffed or to get mad, just to be a little misled, misdirected. So as a cautious reader, you must follow rule number one. Never believe anything. You weed as you read, so you can detect the detours, the dead ends. You can reject the ruses and red herrings. You can suspect the sinister and shadowy and suspicious subtexts as the sleight of hand that they really are. You see, when it comes to a mystery, never believe anything. Rule number two is just as important. Never read ahead. The crux of a mystery is always a secret. Just enough is revealed to arrest our attention, but enough is concealed to capture our curiosity. Something is hidden. And we know that ultimately it will be revealed. So our unspoken contract with the author is that we will keep reading until the mystery is solved, but we will let the author tell the story one page at a time. If we read ahead, we ruin things. So, rule one, never believe a thing. Rule two, never read ahead. Those rules apply only to fiction. They do not apply when you're reading the Bible. With the Bible, you should believe what you read. And you should read ahead. In fact, a last chapter outlook is both a helpful and a wholesome way to live. Knowing that final solution to the mystery of life ahead of time is a huge advantage in maintaining hope and health here in the middle chapters. However, there are times when reading ahead can minimize the dramatic power of the Bible's message. Reading ahead is not just a plot spoiler. It's often an impact stealer as well. When we know what's coming, we tend to see the events we encounter in terms of the outcome that we anticipate. Let me show you what I mean. Two men are trudging up a hill called Moriah after a three-day journey from home. The young man labors under a load of wood to be used for burning the sacrifice. The old man carries a different load, a knife in his hand to obey God's sacrifice, and a knife in his heart as terror duels with trust over what he's about to do. And some of us have read Genesis 22, and because of that, we tend to minimize the dread and the drama of that agonizing ascent. Because we know the outcome. We've read ahead. We've seen the happily ever after. We know that God stays Abraham's hand. We know that God provides a ram caught in the thicket as a substitute for Isaac. We know that Abraham's faith is vindicated and rewarded. Another example, Matthew 14. Jesus bids his disciples farewell, puts them in a boat, and sends them on a sail across the Sea of Galilee. A storm arose in the middle of the night, and in the early morning hours, through a haze of wind-driven mist, they saw Jesus walking on the water. Peter, whose tongue was usually a few steps ahead of his brain, cried out, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." And Jesus said, "Come." And some of us say, yeah, we know. Peter gets wet. That's where reading ahead can rob us. We miss the drama of that miraculous, momentous milestone in Peter's life when he actually stepped over the side of the boat, planted his sandal on a wave, and walked on water. It didn't last long, but Peter connected on water with the creator of water, and for one brief, glorious moment, he found that the laws of physics had been set aside just for him. So, what does this have to do with the study of 1 Samuel, you're asking? At least I hope you're asking, if you're still awake. In the portion of this book that we are considering this morning, from chapter 10, verse 24, through the end of chapter 11, we are continuing our introduction to Saul, the first king of Israel. And some of us have read ahead. We know what happens to Saul. As you read his story, and you see King Saul's royal collapse, as you see God's rejection of him in favor of a man after God's heart, as you see the vengeful villain that Saul becomes, you might conclude that he was just a chump, a fall guy, a placeholder. In short, that he was set up. It's easy to think of Saul as a stooge or a stand-in, to assume that he never really had a chance, that he was the disposable first try, the people's choice, while David was the Lord's choice. But that mindset presupposes that God set up Saul to fail. And friends, that's a nasty assumption. It's really a pernicious thing to assume that God set up Saul to fail. It ignores God's justice. It impugns his goodness. It makes all of the extraordinary divine oversight of the ordinary in Saul's life a cruel joke. And if you believe that God set up Saul to fail, what does it say about your chances for success? For some of us, that may, in fact, be at the root of our inability to fully trust God with our lives. We aren't convinced that we're intended to succeed. In fact, we're a little afraid that we're destined to fail. That perhaps our life is a punchline in some kind of cosmic joke. I do believe that Saul was set up. But I do not believe that Saul was set up to fail. I'm convinced that he was set up to succeed. So this morning, I'd like for us to take a quick look at 1 Samuel chapters 9 and 10 to see how Saul was set up, and then take a look at chapter 11 to see how he was set up to succeed. And I saw that Lori Hilberg brought enough snacks for all of us, so we'll be fine as we spend the next few hours. No, not that long. First, Saul was set up. If you're taking notes, that's point number one. Saul was set up. 1 Samuel chapters 9 and 10 show us several ways Saul was set up. The first, God collected him. In your Bible, look at 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 3. And here we see God collecting Saul. He handpicked him. Hand-delivered him. 1 Samuel 9:3. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. So Kish said to his son Saul, "Take now with you one of the servants and arise, go search for the donkeys." And he passed through the hill country of Ephraim and passed through the land of Shalishah, but they did not find them. Then they passed through the land of Sha'alim, but they were not there. Then he passed through the land of Benjamites, but they did not find them. Now skip down to verse 16, and here is God whispering in Samuel's ear. About this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be prince over my people Israel, and he shall deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines. For I have regarded my people because their cry has come to me. When Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him, "Behold, the man of whom I spoke to you, this one shall rule over my people." Saul set out to find some lost donkeys. And then he got lost. Far from home, without a compass or a clue, he wound up on Samuel's doorstep. And what do you know? Samuel was expecting him. Samuel revealed that Saul's donkeys were found. He also revealed that Saul's destiny was profound. He was going to become king of Israel. In chapter 10, verse 1, it opens with these words. Then Samuel took the flask of oil, poured it on his head, kissed him and said, "Has not the Lord anointed you a ruler over his inheritance?" God collected him. He also directed him. God orchestrated an amazing array of divinely inspired coincidences to confirm both Samuel's announcement and Saul's anointing. 1 Samuel 10, verse 3. Just check this out. This is great. Then you will go on further from there. You will come as far as the Oak of Tabor, and there are three men going up to God at Bethel will meet you. One carrying three kids, another carrying three loaves of bread, and another carrying a jug of wine. And they will greet you and give you two loaves of bread, which you will accept from their hand. Afterward, you will come to the hill of God where the Philistine garrison is, and it shall be as soon as you have come there to the city that you will meet a group of prophets coming down from the high place with harp, tambourine, flute, and a lyre before them, and they will be prophesying. Then the Spirit of the Lord will come upon you mightily, and you shall prophesy with them and be changed into another man. And it shall be when these signs come to you, do for yourself what the occasion requires, for God is with you. God went to a lot of trouble to erase Saul's doubts. Kind of like an artist with an immense canvas and unlimited brushes and colors, God created a masterpiece of coincidence. He orchestrated the activities of at least 7 men, 3 animals, 2 foodstuffs, 4 musical instruments, and 3 landmarks with split-second precision to ensure meetings, greetings, feedings, bleedings, and miraculous proceedings. And if anyone ever could say, God is with me, that certainly could be said of Saul. Saul, God is with you. God collected him. He directed him. He inspected him. Or at least he chose a test that Saul could ace. Look in verse 8 of 1 Samuel 10. And you should go down before me to Gilgal, Samuel said. And behold, I will come down to you to offer burnt offerings and sacrifice peace offerings. You shall wait 7 days until I come to you and show you what you should do. Now we'll read more about this test in chapter 13. But for now, just note that the test did not require strength, agility, or intellectual prowess. He just had to get to Gilgal and hang out for about 168 hours. Sounds like a cinch. Even we could pass that test. Now, remember rule 2, don't read ahead. So God collected him, he directed him, he inspected him, and he also selected him, or at least he superintended the selection process in 1 Samuel 10, verse 20, as they're about to find their king. Thus Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel near, and the tribe of Benjamin was taken by lot. Then he brought the tribe of Benjamin near by its families, and the Matrite family was taken. And Saul, the son of Kish, was taken. But when they looked for him, he could not be found. So it sounds like there were 3 castings of the lot to narrow the field in the search for a king. First, it was a selection of which tribe. The lot revealed Benjamin. And then all the families of Benjamin gathered and they cast a lot, and it was determined it was the family of Matrite. And then of that family, they had all the people represented, and the lot was cast for Saul. Boy, everyone was surprised with the selection, except for God and Samuel and Saul. Look at verse 22. Therefore they inquired further of the Lord, "Has the man come here yet?" The Lord said, "Behold, he's hiding himself by the baggage." That's a rather inauspicious way to be introduced to your new kingdom. But one thing you can say for Saul, he believed God. Another thing you can say about Saul, he was definitely set up. God collected him, directed him, inspected him, selected him, and as we will see, protected him. Because God did set up Saul. Have you ever thought that the place where you are, the people who are in your life, and your current circumstances are not an accident? That they're actually part of a plan? That is, have you considered that you are set up too? Certainly not to be the king of Israel. That job's been taken. But you've been set up to be you, being who you are, where you are, doing what you do, living the adventure that is your life. Now, granted, there may be moments when we wonder about God's grand design. And there may be moments when we wonder just a little about his sense of humor. But I think there's really no doubt. We, like Saul, have been set up. We're where we are on purpose. And fortunately for him and for us, Saul was set up to succeed. Wonder what Saul, I keep wanting to call him Paul, old habits, New Testament guy. I wonder what Saul was thinking as he hid by the baggage. I suspect he was playing all kinds of what if and what now sort of mind games. 400 years earlier, Moses faced a similar challenge. God called him to deliver Israel from captivity in Egypt. So in Exodus chapter 4, verse 1, Moses asks God a question as he plays the what if game. He asks, "What if they will not believe me or listen to what I say? For they may say, 'The Lord has not appeared to you.'" And the Lord, in response, asked Moses a question. The Lord said to him, "What's that in your hand?" And Moses replied, "A staff." After all, he had been a shepherd for the better part of 40 years. It was the tool of his trade. And that staff, which had previously been his connection to a herd, was now about to become his conduit to heaven. But isn't it interesting that God had prepared Moses ahead of time? He already had in hand the only tool he would ever need. Even though he didn't realize it at that moment, Moses already had all he needed to succeed. And I would like to suggest that the same was true for Saul. I think there are four areas we see in chapter 11 in which God set up Saul to succeed. The first of those areas was the folks in his life. Look in verse 23 of chapter 10. "So they ran, took him from there, and when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward." It's like having a Shaq moment. "And Samuel said to all the people, 'Do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? Surely there is no one like him among all the people.' So all the people shouted and said, 'Long live the king!' Then Samuel told the people in the ordinances of the kingdom and wrote them in the book and placed it before the Lord. And Samuel sent all the people away, each one to his house. And Saul also went to his house at Gibeah, and the valiant men whose hearts God had touched went with him. But certain worthless men said, 'How can this one deliver us?' And they despised him and did not bring him any present, but he kept silent." I think these verses show us four different kinds of folks in Saul's life. First, we see his coach. We know him as Samuel. Samuel says of himself in the next chapter, I know, I'm reading ahead, in chapter 12, verse 2, he says, "I am old and gray." In other words, Samuel was at the point of life where he was a seasoned citizen. He had lots of miles, lots of memories, lots of maturity, and those are the perfect credentials for a coach. He had lots of experience, and he had the advantage of perspective being a few steps ahead in the race. As his coach, Samuel sided with Saul. In chapter 9, verse 20, when he first meets him, "As for your donkeys, which were lost 3 days ago, don't set your mind on them. They've been found. And for whom is all that is desirable in Israel? Is it not for you and for your father's household?" He sided with him. He prided in him. In 10, verse 24, Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? Surely there is no one like him among all the people." He also guided for Saul in verse 8 of chapter 10. "You shall go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I shall come down to you to offer burnt offerings and sacrifice peace offerings. You shall wait 7 days until I come to you and show you what you should do." He sided with him, prided in him, guided for him. Samuel was Saul's coach. Saul also had some cheerleaders. We see them in verse 24 of chapter 10. Samuel said to the people, "You see him in the Lord's chosen? Wow! There's no one like him." And all the people shouted and said, "Long live the king!" I hope you have some cheerleaders in your life. I truly hope you're married to one. I have experienced 34 years of persistent and enthusiastic cheerleading from my wife, Denny. I don't deserve it, but I certainly enjoy it. As a wise man once said, behind every successful man is a good woman and a surprised mother-in-law. Saul had a coach. Saul had cheerleaders. Saul had colleagues. Look in verse 26 again. Saul also went to his house at Gibeah, and the valiant men whose hearts God had touched went with him. Proverbs 27:17 says, iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. I hope there are some good people in your life. I hope some iron on iron sparks are flying as the Lord keeps you sharp. I personally have the great luxury of working with a team of five men and one woman who are valiant and godly and creative and so smart it's sometimes scary. So he had a coach, he had cheerleaders, he had colleagues. And in verse 27, we find out he also had critics. Certain worthless men said, how could this one deliver us? And they despised him and did not bring him any present, but he kept silent. You realize, of course, that no matter what you do, no matter how well-intentioned you are, someone will find fault. As Elbert Hubbard wisely observed, to avoid criticism, do nothing, say nothing, be nothing. I kind of suspect that God actually sprinkles critics into our lives. Not to torment us, but to refine us. For you see, if our ideas cannot survive critics, then they're flimsy. If our values cannot survive critics, then they're puny. If our beliefs cannot survive critics, then they are phony. Proverbs 15:31 reveals a potential benefit of criticism, whether or not it is constructive. This is what we read. He whose ear listens to life-giving reproof will dwell among the wise. And as an additional caution, the book of Proverbs also tells us in 10:17, he who forsakes reproof goes astray. In 12:1 says, he who hates reproof is stupid. In 15:10 says, he who hates reproof will die. Critics are inevitable. And like weeds, new ones spring up to replace the old crop. Saul's response to criticism is actually very instructive. It is both clever and effective. Did you catch it in verse 27? He kept silent. That's good advice. So, Saul was set up to succeed with the folks in his life. There was one person, however, who was a very significant part of Saul's setup for success, but he was a very unwelcome party crasher. We meet him in chapter 11, verse 1. Now Nahash the Ammonite came up and besieged Jabesh-Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, make a covenant with us and we'll serve you. But Nahash the Ammonite said to them, I will make it with you on this condition, that I will gouge out the right eye of every one of you. Thus I will make it a reproach on all Israel. And the elders of Jabesh said to him, let us alone for 7 days that we may send messengers throughout the territory of Israel. Then if there is no one to deliver us, we'll come out to you. Then the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and spoke these words in the hearing of the people, and all the people lifted up their voices and wept. Now behold, Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen, and he said, what's the matter with the people? that they weep. So they related to him the words of the men of Jabesh. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul mightily when he heard these words, and he became very angry. There had been bad blood between the Ammonites and the Gileadites for generations. Way back in Judges 10 through 12, we see some earlier skirmishes during the time of Jephthah. So Nahash, bad dude that he was, apparently felt it was time for a little payback. So he and his armies camped against Jabesh Gilead. Residents of that town knew that they were outflanked, outmanned, and outgunned. So they sought terms of surrender. And Nahash offered a really grisly deal. The cost of survival would be the right eye of every resident. Finding themselves between a rock and a blind spot, the elders of Jabesh asked for a 7-day truce so that they might solicit help from their fellow countrymen. Now, Nahash was either a very good sport, or more likely, was so supremely confident in his superior forces and the unlikelihood of anyone being foolish enough to get in the middle of this fight that he granted the 1-week reprieve. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, truly back at the ranch, Saul was returning from the fields after a day of plowing. And he heard the din of despair, the sounds of his neighbors weeping and wailing. So he asked, what was wrong? And when he found out, two things happened. Number one, the Spirit of God came upon him mightily. And number two, he became angry. No, that's not quite right. Look again at verse 6. He became very angry. This is actually one of those rare times when I prefer the NIV to the NASB, because it says, he burned with anger. Isn't that interesting? The Spirit of God came upon him and he burned with anger. And I think here we see a second way Saul was set up to succeed. It was his flashpoint. Anger is one of those things that none of us is very good at. You realize, of course, the Bible does not tell us not to be angry. It tells us not to be quick to anger. It tells us to be angry and yet not to sin, but it doesn't proscribe anger. Some of us are a little quick to anger. So we need to develop patience in order to lengthen our fuses so that our words and deeds don't become explosive and destructive. Some of us, though, are so laid back that we never get angry. We see the money changers in the temple and say, whatever. We probably need to find a little gumption or a little passion or something. We need to get a flashpoint. Something that makes us ignitable at the right time. I think it's fascinating that Saul's reaction of anger was part of God's plan. In other words, he was set up for success with his temper, his flashpoint. Let that one hang just a moment. Mom, the preacher told me I should be angry. That happens. It's a critic thing. Saul, like every one of us, is a complex bundle of talents, temperament, traits, and training. That bundle defines us. At times, it even defies us because it contains some good stuff, some bad stuff, and some downright ugly stuff. Our personality bundle seems to come with paired qualities. You get one trait, and you kind of get the flip side as well. They go together. For instance, If you're creative, then you may also be kind of moody. If you're a visionary, you might also be a little stubborn, too. If you're a leader, others will mistakenly, of course, think that you're a little hard of listening. If you're decisive, you may also be critical and impatient. If you're sensitive, you may also be a little indecisive, even a pushover. Now, I'm not trying to reduce human psychology to a two-for-the-price-of-one concept of flip sides. I'm just observing that all of us are a complex bundle of talents, temperament, traits, and training. And if Saul was set up for success by means of his personality, then that may suggest the same is true for us as well. He was in the right place, surrounded by the right people, and he was the right person for God's plan to be fulfilled. And so are we, flip sides and all. Let's look at another quality of Saul that indicates he was set up to succeed: his faith. In chapter 11, verse 7, "And he took a yoke of oxen, cut them in pieces, and sent them throughout the territory of Israel by the hand of messengers, saying, 'Whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen.' Then the dread of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out as one man. And he numbered them in Bezek, and the sons of Israel were 300,000, and the men of Judah 30,000. And they said to the messengers who had come, 'Thus you shall say to the men of Jabesh Gilead, tomorrow, by the time the sun is hot, you shall have deliverance.' So the messengers went and told the men of Jabesh, and man, were they glad." Saul, in his anger, hacked a pair of oxen into bloody pieces and sent them throughout Israel, probably using fed ox. It was his first act as king. And judged by the results, wildly successful. They came out as one man. Now, in his estimate, Saul, I think the messengers are just echoing Saul here, he could have been a little more diplomatic. He could have toned it down just a little bit. After all, he was a new king. He had no track record of success yet. Lost causes, large casualties, they could tarnish his reputation. They could have put a crimp in his crown. But Saul didn't seem to be too worried about failure right here. He seemed to know that he was set up to succeed. Implicit in that declaration, "Tomorrow by noon you'll be delivered," implicit in that declaration was absolute faith in God's plan. Now, the passive voice of that verse doesn't say who's going to do the delivering. But if we read ahead, again, just this once, to verse 13, I think we'll discover what Saul was thinking. He says, "Today the Lord has accomplished deliverance in Israel." Somehow, Saul knew that what God could do, he would do. Now, to the eyes of the unbelieving, faith always looks risky and sometimes crazy. And maybe it is, but it sure beats the alternative. Look at verse 10. "As the residents of Jabesh Gilead say to Nahash, the men of Jabesh said, 'Tomorrow we will come out to you, and you may do to us whatever seems good to you.' And it happened the next morning that Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the camp at the morning watch and struck down the Ammonites until the heat of the day. And it came about that those who survived were scattered so that no two of them were left together." So Nahash and his hairy band of henchmen were defeated. And the Jabesh Gileadites were delivered, just as Saul had said. He was set up for success because he had faith. He believed that God would do what he could do. The final indicator that Saul was set up for success, I think we find in verses 12 and 13. It's his attitude of forgiveness. Then the people said to Samuel, "Who is he that said, 'Shall Saul reign over us?' Bring them in, that we may put them to death." But Saul said, "Not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished deliverance in Israel." Proverbs 19:11 says, "It is a man's glory to overlook a transgression." This time, Saul succeeded. He actually passed on the opportunity to permanently silence his critics. His forgiveness made him a success. And if you love happy endings, you're going to love the last two verses of chapter 11. Samuel said to the people, "Come, let us go to Gilgal, renew the kingdom there." So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they also offered sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord. And there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. It is my contention that Saul was set up, that God collected him, directed him, inspected him, selected him, and protected him. I also believe that God set up Saul to succeed. Everything Saul would need to succeed was already in place. His folks, his flashpoint, his faith, and his forgiveness. So what does that mean for us? Just kind of a couple of little grab bag applications we might make for our own lives. Let me state them personally so that as you hear them and say them to yourselves, they are personal for you too. God gives me all I need to succeed. God gives me all I need to succeed. Each of us, according to the Bible, is fearfully and wonderfully made. Our individualized and personalized bundle of talents, temperament, traits, and training is perfect for God's personalized plan for each of us. You have everything you need to succeed. Another application or observation. I almost made it all the way through, Randy, without losing my mic. Success usually comes without applause. Success is not so much about achievement or accomplishment or wealth or power or fame or influence or prestige. True success is more about being the person God wants you to be. Doing the right things with the right people for the right reasons. And a final observation. Success itself may be a little overrated. As Saul will learn soon enough, to obey is better. In fact, Saul's set up for success actually becomes the seeds for his eventual failure. His friends, flashpoint, faith, and forgiveness figure into his future as well, but not successfully. But that's a study for another day, and that requires reading ahead. Let's pray together.